Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Okay, I am standing back from this computer because I fear that my pod partner may be about to explode.
Oh no, I'm going to be very controlled, but it's a really juicy episode today. Oh, my friend Prince Andrew has been in the news this week. There's a court case going on. It's been going on for a while now where he's been receiving, well, he can't explain why more than £1 million has been paid into his account, that of his wife and his daughter. I talked to the man in this case, a man called Selman Turk, who claimed that it was a birthday present for a man he hardly knew.
All right. Yeah. We'll get to it. Cool your jets.
So that's the short version. Now we'll give you the long.
People might have expected us to do the spy stories that we said we'd do this week. The first of those will actually come down on Wednesday, because we decided to do this in a bit of a hurry. And if anybody wants background, we already have an episode actually in which Andrew talks a lot about the work he's doing on Prince Andrew for his current book and an earlier episode of the pod. But it's turning into one of those Titanic struggles. In the blue corner, Andrew Loney, the most unlikely rebel in Britain, monarchist, toff, Tory, and yet fiercely opposed to lies and obfuscation and all manner of official blockage on getting access to documents by historians like himself. It's been going on for a long time, but a couple of new things happened which made us think we should really do a show.
I'm still getting, still putting in FOI requests for example, the Duke of York's travels as a trade envoy, which was a public position. And I've been told that none of these files will be released, or indeed files going back 40 years, because the worry is it will distress him if this material is revealed. So this is a man, given the publicity he's had, I would think it would take more than some files from 40 years ago to distress him.
All right. Well, I'm just going to do my catch up. And then we'll leap into this in more detail, because we had a lovely response to Laura Thompson. I don't know if you've seen, Andrew, lots of lovely comments.
I have, yes. No, people like it. Well, we've got lots of new Agatha Christie fans, I think.
Lots of Agatha Christie fans tuned in. And we were talking about, you know, whether we should have more sort of sexy, salacious titles to attract a crowd. And Jane Buckland came up with a great phrase. Yes, more Vava Boom is always good, she said. Vava Boom. Maybe she meant Vava Boom. I think Vava Boom is better. So look out for more Vava Boom from us going forward. Lovely email from Kathy Mottram suggesting various European royal stories. Which
yes.
We're going to do soon.
We're definitely going to do that.
Princess Marie-Louise of Schleswig-Holstein. Not a household name, but one of many great stories.
She will be after our podcast.
She certainly will. And my favourite comment of the week. Maybe this one will get the mug for March. Sam McDonald, 83. Do you know, he says, I think someone needs to come up with a bingo card for this Scandalmongers podcast. Lord Mountbatten's name would definitely be on it.
Yes, I think he would have a good chance.
Okay, and finally, because I could go on. Hala Elkoza, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Hala. She loved Laura. And she said all of her favourite episodes, well, her favourite two were Laura shows, the Mitford Sisters, and Agatha. And Rebecca Day, who joined in the conversation, said how much she liked Laura too. So, yeah, she's definitely one of our gang, Laura, I look
Yes,
forward.
no. Well, we're keen to have both Valentine Lowe and Lady Colin Campbell back to
Maybe in the
talk
same
soon
programme.
or indeed the same week, yeah, to talk about some of the latest disclosures and royal history, things that are going on there.
All right, let's get back to it then. You don't know where to start. We should maybe recap a little bit on what you told us before about all the work you've done on Andrew for your book. You know, we talked about the Epstein affair. Most people think it's a sex scandal. Well, it is a sex scandal, but you're also very interested in the financial side of Epstein and what Andrew and Fergie sort of got out of it.
Yeah, well, what's becoming very clear is that he used his role as a trade envoy to basically do private business. People who had given money to his wife and paid off debts were being taken on these government-funded trips. He was sharing documents which were used to brief him, and he's not come clear on why these people were on these trips and what business was done. He was often staying not in the embassy but in hotels, where it was clearly much more difficult to scrutinize what he was up to. And it's very clear also he was in business with some of these people. Both of them have been running a whole series of businesses using different false names. He uses the name Andrew Inverness. He's called the Earl of Inverness, his Scottish title. But one of the people he deals with is David Rowland, who set up a bank, the Bank Haviland, which specializes in people basically who can't borrow money from anyone else. And Haviland has become a very close friend, has been on these trips, Roland rather, has been on these trips. But there are a whole series of other people that he has been doing business with and been doing it in a very secretive way under false names. And one has to wonder, he's meant to be a public official. What is he doing business with these people? Quite separately from his government role, people who are he's in hock to, in effect. We know about Epstein giving money to Fergie, but there were a whole series of other people who gave money to her. And again, that we have no evidence that though she vowed to repay this money, that this money was ever repaid. So I think there are a lot of very sort of a lot of questions here. And of course, one of the things we thought we would talk about is royal finances. And one of the problems with the royal finances is there is no scrutiny. Royal wills are sealed. I mean, they've been sealed now for just over 100 years. And so there's no way one can tell how money is passed down through the generations. I mean, all the royals are worth quite large sums of money. We were able to find out a little bit about Princess Margaret because her will was unsealed for a man called Robert Brown, who claimed to be her illegitimate son. And through that, we discovered that she had 7.5 million pounds when she died, having divested herself of 12 million before that on the 7-year scale to her children. The Queen Mum as well, something had something like 70 million pounds when she died. She was still receiving over £600,000 a year from the sovereign, well, what became the sovereign grant, the civil list. And you've got to ask questions. That what large sums of money being paid to them, and is this money being used for their own interests or being used to support their royal duties. I mean, even Prince Philip was receiving over £300,000 a year when he died, when he gave up royal duties in 2017. So,
So, does anybody, apart from you, does anybody care about this at the official level, at the government level, at the legal level?
Yes. I mean, for example, 20 years ago, 65 MPs signed a motion in the House of Commons saying that the royals should have a register of interests in the way that any government ministers have, and that went nowhere. There have been even public accounts committees looking at royal finances. The fact that the Duchy of Lancaster and the Duchy of Cornwall, which raise huge sums of money for the monarchy, and are outside, in a sense, any arrangement, are not properly audited. I mean, we just don't know. They're not subject to any corporation tax. And, you know, I think it's very important that there should be transparency on these things, that there isn't something going on. I mean, I just know from my research on the Duke of Windsor that, I mean, he had saved an awful lot of money from the duchies before he came to, well, before he abdicated. And, you know, he was giving, for example, Wallace huge sums of money and jewels. I mean, 3 or 4 million pounds worth of jewels in 1934 and 35 alone. So, you know, and this was the problem when they wanted to give him some money on the civil list after he abdicated. They realized it was rather embarrassing because he had made a lot of money. Again, you know, Balmoral and Sandringham are treated as private estates of the monarchy, but this money was these estates were bought with money that was given to Queen Victoria as part of her royal duties, and she just basically sidelined it to pay for these properties. So I think there are a lot of questions that have been asked, and you know, as I say, the press asked questions. I mean, Parliament has been asking questions. A lot of things have just slipped through quietly. The move under George Osborne towards the sovereign grant, which was is now 25% basically of Crown estate income, and of course is going up because it has a huge property empire and a lot of money being made from offshore wind power. That was just sneaked through Parliament with a small committee, not properly debated by anyone. And often we will find announcements like this are just pushed through in a way where there can be no proper scrutiny.
So is it your case that they shouldn't have this money, or is it your case that they should just be more open about
I think
where
they should be
it's
more
coming
open
from?
about it. I mean, I think they should. Well, I mean, I'm not sure they need quite so much money. But I think they should have it. I mean, if we're going to have a monarchy, we should have a decent monarchy that operates properly. But I think we should be aware if this is taxpayers' money, how it's being spent. And of course, a lot of the stuff, this is when we talk about the sovereign grant, which is now over, I think, £80 million a year. But we've got to also think of the costs of security, the costs of running the Lord Lieutenants. A lot of the money is which goes to the monarch is for staff, for example, is paid through government departments rather than through this sovereign grant. And so, you know, a lot of it is disguised in the way you disguise a secret vote for the intelligence services. So I just think it just seems very Rotarian, the whole thing. You know, the more open we are, the more, you know, I think it is very important that there should be some transparency and there should be some accountability.
Sure. Well, we'll get to the freedom of information in a minute, I think. But and we're going to talk to somebody about that too in this show. But let's go back to this court case, because the I guess the back is the background to this court case that kind of.
Yes, I mean, we only really know about these payments to the Yorkes, which were to both Andrew Fergie and, in fact, one of the daughters, was because a woman was suing, a Turkish woman was suing the man that she'd left to be responsible for her money. And he was busy basically paying this money out to the Yorkes. Now,
And
she thought
what
that.
was this man's business? What was his job?
Well, he was a former Goldman Sachs banker, and he was basically her financial advisor. She thought that some of this money had been paid to Andrew because he had got her a passport.
What?
And I think it's slightly worrying if people feel that you know, members of the royal family can get people passports. But I think the reality is that this money was basically being fenced. This is money that's is basically commission that's been paid to both Andrew and Fergie for services rendered as brand ambassadors, commission for introductions,
And
and
this is
which they haven't
personal
declared.
money to them
Personal money in their personal
from a
accounts.
businessman who is now in trouble with the law.
Yes,
We
well,
don't
he.
quite know what they did for him, or do we?
Well, I know, and I'm slightly saving that for my book. Yes, otherwise we don't. The judge certainly in this case said that this is all very suspicious, and they have paid back. They claim some of this money, but they never seem to question it. And it's only to say because this High Court case has come out, it's been running, in fact, for a long time, and we just get different stages. In fact, the stage you just had is the man, Soman Turk, has been held in contempt of court for refusing to release a lot of information to the court. But no one really has been covering it until this week. The Telegraph did a bit, the Bloomberg did a bit. But it's only now that the papers have slightly woken up to what seems to be going on, which is rather fishy. But, you know, we know that lots of money has been paid to both of them for being introducers of business, being brand ambassadors. There's a man called Johnny Hon, who has been paying Zara Phillips, Peter Phillips, and as well as Beatrice and Fergie for basically introducing him or being appearing with him, photos with him, to promote his business in Hong Kong and China. And there is a case, another case going through the courts at the moment with something called Gate Ventures, which is basically brought together a lot of Chinese investors to put on theatre and various other things. But what hasn't been explained is this money that was collected, a lot of the money was then loaned to Fergie for her companies, was loaned to her for her personal use, which had nothing really to do with Gate Ventures. They're now got a court case where a lot of the investors are wondering what's happened to their money. And again, we haven't had any answers from Fergie on what exactly why she received literally hundreds of thousands of pounds and what she did. We've also she supposedly resigned, but she was still active many months after she claimed to have left the company. So this has again just come through a court case where basically people fell out. And one's just got to wonder how many of these other things are going on that we just don't know about.
So what's the answer? What more rights should we have? Should you have as somebody who's trying to investigate the royal
Well, I
family
mean, we have this
to
ridiculous
get?
thing at the moment where the Royal Family exempt from the Freedom of Information Act. And so this is one of the problems I've had researching them. And there seems no reason for them to be exempt. There should be a public interest test here, at least, a proper public interest test. Fergie would say that she's not a member of the royal family, but they're still finding it very difficult to get any material on her. The excuse there is personal data. But, you know, some of this material I've been trying to get on Andrew is things like parachute training 1978. And it can't possibly be sensitive. And if it is, bits of it should be redacted. So,
Well,
I think
you
that would
showed me
be
a
the
few
first step.
emails earlier this week that you've got from your attempts to get information, which we probably don't want to show anybody, but you could talk about how frustrating it is to try and find out what's going on without
Well, I
it.
mean, yes, good example is his time as a trade envoy, as I say, a public position controlled by the Department of Trade and the Foreign Office. Alternatively, when I put FOIs in, I get responses from both of them saying they have so much material I need to narrow my request. I narrow my request and they say they haven't got anything. And I've been focusing on one particular trip he went to Bahrain on, and I've rephrased that question, I think probably a dozen times now. And each time they claim they don't have material. And there is an obligation under Freedom of Information to assist someone. You can't just play on semantics. If you ask for a telegram and it was an email, they should at least say we have emails. And this, you know, is just obfuscation and frankly is trying to prevent legitimate research from being conducted. And that's wrong. And how can we, you know, respect an institution which is not being open? And
Okay,
what are
well,
they hiding?
we're going to talk to Britain's leading guru on freedom of information in a minute. Although I don't think he wants to talk particularly about Andrew to us. But what is it you say they won't let me know this and they keep writing? Who are they in this instance?
Well, they are the government departments, so the Foreign Office and Department of Trade. But it could be the Ministry of Defence, for example. I put in requests on the Royal Flight. They claim that the flight logs have been destroyed, which I find very hard to believe. Metropolitan Police, I think we're entitled to know how much is being spent on security for Andrew, particularly no longer holds a position. How much was spent, for example, on protecting his daughters on their year off, when other members of the royal family's children, like Edward and Anne's children, don't receive police protection? How much did it cost for the open top ride after Eugenie's wedding around Windsor? How much was spent on security there? That wasn't totally necessary. So, I mean, it's just trying to get answers from government departments. And one of the problems is they hide behind a whole series of exemptions, mainly data protection and this one about the royal family. So that would be a start. And most of us have to if there's material on things and public money is involved, we have to answer, for that pay, for that expense.
Well, look, I know you have to be fairly careful what you say, partly because you want to save things for your book, but also I suspect the lawyers will have to read your book quite carefully
Exactly. I
before it's
have to.
published. But what is it you sort of suspect has been going on with Andrew, that these missions that he did for over many years, supposedly representing Britain, and no doubt he did help get some deals done during those missions, what is it you suspect he was also doing?
Well, I think both he and Fergie, and it's a joint biography, have used their royal position to basically line their own pocket. We know that Fergie has been doing all sorts of things in the States, not just writing autobiographies, but promoting sort of cranberry juice, crockery, Weight Watchers, you name it. And she's not got these roles except as being a member of the royal family. She trades on that in the way that the Duke and Duchess of Sussex do. She's no longer Her Royal Highness, but that's sometimes being used. But if she wasn't a duchess, gullible Americans would not be buying some of her product. And again, with Andrew, there are a lot of questions about exactly whether he was really promoting British trade or whether he was promoting himself and his chums.
Yes, and it's the people they mingle with. I mean, I think to see Fergie advertising a juicer on some American shopping channel, we might think it's a bit tacky, but it's a little bit different from, say, Andrew hanging out with Epstein and then money arriving in his account from Epstein and all the other potential Epsteins who he's been associating with. And what's he done
Yeah,
before
well, I
that?
mean, Andrew, it appears, was in a reference, in effect, for Epstein, and so Epstein, the first time round, m managed to evade, the jurisdiction of the law, by the support of some very powerful people who played down what he was up to in Florida and elsewhere. But I think it's very hard to have respect for an institution where you feel people have got their noses in the trough and where they're are behaving in a pretty sleazy manner, whether that's consorting with convicted paedophiles or dictators, as he was. I mean, there are a whole series of people that he's linked with in Libya, in Central Asia, and elsewhere, are not the sort of people that you expect a member of the royal family to be meeting and consorting with and possibly doing business with. And we have this big scandal of Sunning Hill, the house that was given to him as a wedding present by the Queen, which he was trying to sell. No one wanted to buy it. It was valued at about £6 million. He'd moved by this stage to Royal Lodge. It was in a very dilapidated condition. And one of the people that he was doing business with in Central Asia bought this for £15 million, way over the asking price, and then pulled it down. Now, with this return for favors that he had done him in his trade role, these are questions which remain unanswered. And there are a lot of these sort of people wandering around in his life, who he can't really explain. And the fact that it's just covered up the whole time, the fact they're using, not using their real names, they're working, for example, she was buying houses through nominees. It doesn't look good, and it does raise questions.
So you spend a lot of time banging your head against a brick wall on this. And those who might remember Lounygate will know that Andrew has also been put under some forms of surveillance. Some of the questions he's been asking, not only about Prince Andrew, but also about Louis Mountbatten, I suspect. And you've probably lost a few friends. You might have lost a chance of a knighthood, mate. I hate to break the news to you.
I think I'm not going to even get the British Empire Medal at this rate.
And you've put yourself outside the kind of cozy cartel of official biographers for the nice, easy reading biographies. But you're still a monarchist, is that right?
Yes, I believe in monarchy. I think it is the best alternative. It's better than the other alternatives, and that means that. And I think many of them do a really good job. And we should respect what they do and admire what they do. And clearly, there are fewer and fewer doing it. And I think that these bad apples let the side down. It's exactly like the SAS. I think any member of the SAS would be against the fact that if there was a shoot to kill policy or anything else. you know, this is not the way we should operate in Britain. We operate within the rule of law. And, you know, the way that the monarchy earns respect and is behaving well, not by covering it all up. And, you know, I think the danger is if it gets covered up, that people, there's a vacuum there for speculation and fantasy. And that will clearly move people towards a much more Republican point of view. So I'm afraid the Harrys, the Andrews, and the Duke of Windsor really let the side down. It doesn't mean one's against the institution.
And you are satisfied that Harry should be in this rogues gallery? Because, I mean, he's no longer a working royal. He's broken off with them.
He needs to make a living, doesn't he? Well, I think he's betrayed the trust that, you know, he had as a member of the royal family. From what he said, you know, we as historians can't find out things from 100 years ago, and yet he can give away secrets from a few weeks ago of private conversations. So, I mean, yes, I think he has abused his position as a member of the royal family. People don't really make any distinction now that he's left the royal family. He's still got his title. He's still raising money. No one would be giving Harry Windsor the sort of money he's been getting if he was anyone else. So, yeah, I do put him in that category. And I just feel sorry for all the royals who just get on with public duty day after day, often pretty boring stuff, while these guys basically move on the jet set and they're complete hypocrites in the way they operate.
Gosh, well, you're a man of stern principle, Andrew. And you've lived your principles and you're still living them. I feel you'll make a breakthrough one day with this book probably is it. And things will have to change. But we also, you know, this very much speaks to something we've talked about a lot, freedom of information, how hard it is for people, legitimate writers, journalists, biographers, to get at the truth. So we've arranged to have a chat with somebody who knows a lot about this. Do you want to introduce
Yes.
him?
Yes, Martin Rosenbaum is one of the leading FOI experts. He worked for a long time for the BBC using FOI to break stories for the BBC. He is a regular speaker at conferences. And in fact, he and I were at a conference yesterday on Friday. So we're recording this today before we go out, where actually a whole series of organizations came together with, for example, the Information Commissioner's Office, and indeed a member from the Cabinet Office, to make the points that freedom of information has been going backwards since the Act was passed 25 years ago. And hopefully, with a change of government, there may be some changes there. The only changes we want is for proper enforcement and for the statutory law to be obeyed, which it isn't being obeyed at the moment by the Paris Public Authority.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Particularly some of the government departments.
Okay, that sounds very comprehensive. So I'm sorry we didn't bring you any spies, but the spies are coming soon. Spies and sexual scandal and establishment hypocrisy and all the things we love. But for the rest of this episode, let's talk some more about freedom of information, shall we?
Yeah, let's do that.
All right. See you all later. Bye.
Bye. Well, we're delighted to welcome Martin Rosenbaum to talk about freedom of information this week. He's a leading expert. He spent a career at the BBC basically being their FOI man, and that created stories for them. I don't know if you came across Martin, Phil, when you
were... I'm not sure I did, Martin. Sorry.
but he's also written a book recently about FOI, a guide. And I mean, for those of our listeners who don't understand freedom of information, can you tell us a little bit about the FOI acts that came in and their purpose, and how they work?
Absolutely. So the basic point of freedom of information is to give more accountability of public authorities towards the citizen. So citizens are more able to know what public authorities are doing with public money. They can get more involved, they can participate, they can learn information that is useful to them, and so on. So the Freedom of Information Act gives you the right to ask questions of public authorities, ask them for information, and sometimes to get it. You don't always get it. There are numerous reasons why your request might be turned down. Sometimes it's too expensive to answer. That is a very common one. But there are also 23 exemptions laid down in the Act, which is about certain subject matter, which it's difficult to get access to. So the presumption is that you can get the information unless there's a reason why it shouldn't be given to you. But unfortunately, there are often lots of reasons why a public authority will refuse to give it to you.
And are there scandals that have been exposed because of FOI?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. I mean, one that sort of sticks in my mind, this was last year, involving a sort of secret behind the scenes system within Liverpool Council, a council which has had a lot of problems recent years. And this had a secret behind the scenes system whereby councillors were able basically to get parking tickets cancelled. So if a councillor got a parking ticket they didn't like, instead of appealing against it in the normal way that any other person would have to do through a formal process, there were council officials who would just cancel the parking ticket for them. And this was exposed in the Liverpool Echo last year. I think it took quite a lot of effort, a lot of delay they faced in trying to get this information out there. And that, to my mind, is absolutely a scandal. Now, one of the points about FOI is it doesn't just apply to central government. It applies to local councils. It applies to hospitals. It applies to all parts of the public sector. So in terms of how it can expose scandals, we're not necessarily talking about things that happen at the height of central government. We are sometimes talking about things like that, which happen in local services, but also deserve to be exposed.
An international thing. I mean, every country basically has an FOI procedure. I mean, some presumably work better than others.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most countries have an FOI process, that's for sure. I've used the system in some other countries, in the United States, for example, Sweden and Norway. Sweden and Norway have particularly open, particularly responsive FOI systems. So it varies from one country to another. But freedom of information is absolutely an international norm. And as a general rule, you don't have to be a citizen of the other country to use their FOI system. There are some exceptions to that. New Zealand is one, for example. By and large, it's an international process and you can use it wherever you are in the world.
And so what are the stories?
We've spoken a couple of times. Sorry, Andrew. We've spoken a couple of times to Andy Webb, who did all the work on the Princess Diana Martin Bashir story. So I always get told off for this. Diana, Princess of Wales, Martin Bashir story. Was that as consequence of the FOI rules, or was that something separate?
No, absolutely. I mean, he's been fighting this FOI battle with the BBC, my former employer. He's been trying to get information out of them through FOI and has succeeded in getting some information. I think he's the stage of the process he's now at. He's got a tribunal case. Yeah. And it has to be said, the tribunal has been quite critical of the BBC for the way the BBC has dealt with his freedom of information request. But absolutely, that's another example of using freedom of information by journalists to get information which otherwise you wouldn't be able to get, because FOI does give you a legal right in some circumstances to get information from public authorities.
And I guess the other one is sitting over there in that box, Mr. Lodi. I guess you're familiar with his struggles.
Troublemaker.
Do you think they show that the system could still be improved?
Absolutely. And I've got to say, Andrew, I think the way you've been treated by the system is absolutely disgraceful. The way that the Southampton University and the Cabinet Office have treated your request for information is appalling. And that is, you know, a case of the system working very badly. And it's got to be said, in my experience, the Cabinet Office is certainly one of the worst public authorities, perhaps the worst public authority when it comes to being delaying and obstructive and difficult. You know, and I've had cases where For example, I got information about how Prince Charles, as he then was some time ago, had been lobbying the government of Tony Blair against the use of genetically modified foods. And so I got copies of these letters where Charles had been saying this to Blair. So this was him as Prince lobbying the government. And that was a request to the Cabinet Office. It took me nearly 3 years, and I needed to make 4 complaints during that process to the Information Commissioner's office, because the Cabinet Office were being so obstructive all the way along the road that it needed 4 complaints to the ICO at each stage at which they overruled the Cabinet Office and said, no, you've got it, he's right, you've got to do this, supply him with the information, and so on. So absolutely, FOI does not always work well. As I say, I think, you know, you've been treated particularly badly, Andrew. And, you know, sometimes even when it does work well, it actually requires a lot of persistence, a lot of determination to squeeze out of public authorities the information that you're entitled to.
And is the regulator doing their job? I mean, here the ICO clearly supported you, but do you think in some ways the ICO isn't as effective as it should be?
So I think the ICO is getting better. And I think what it's done recently in the past couple of years is it speeded up its own processes, which is absolutely vital if it's then going to say to public authorities, you're not acting quickly enough. It's speeded up its own processes, and it's also taken now to prioritising important cases, cases which raise big issues in the public interest, get speeded through the process more than cases which might be important to the individual involved, but really don't have wider ramifications. And I think they're good things. It's also started cracking down harder on some of the worst public authorities. We've seen it issue enforcement notices in the past couple of years, for example, against the Ministry of Defence, the Environment Agency, certain councils like Croydon Council, for example, places which were very, very slow and difficult in dealing with FOI requests. And it's now intervening in that much more than it used to. To what extent it will affect the wider public sector, we don't yet know. But I think it's one of just want to make one other point about the ICO is it's speeding up its processes, but I don't always agree with its decision. You know, sometimes its decisions go in my favor, sometimes its decisions go against me or against other requesters. And I don't always, you know, fair enough, it's not always going to go with me, but I do think sometimes there are flaws with the quality of its decisions. And I'd like to see it improve its quality of decision making in the same way that has actually greatly improved, I think, some of the procedural problems that it had.
I mean, the next stage is to go to the what's called the first tier tribunal. I mean, do you do that? Do you think that actually the courts are the last bulwark here? Or do you think, again, there's a sense of just following the status quo?
No, so I've taken quite a few cases, the first tier tribunal, as you know, have numerous other people who've been requesting information. And sometimes the tribunals rule in my favour and sometimes they rule against me. You know, that's inevitable when you're dealing with courts that's sometimes going to be the case. I think there's a bit of a problem with the first tier tribunal at the moment that because of its workload, it's actually very slow and there's a lot more delay now in that part of the system than there used to be a few years ago. And that's an organisational issue that needs to be sort of sorted out. But I've got to say, I think that even in cases where I have lost my case at the tribunal, my arguments have been heard. I think maybe they haven't had the agreement that they deserved, but I don't think I would say in any particular case that no notice was taken of my arguments. I think they heard my arguments, and sometimes I won and sometimes I lost. I think the tribunal operates reasonably well.
Right. Okay. I mean, could we learn from Scandinavia? I mean, they clearly haven't had huge leakages of national security or people committing suicide or whatever as a result of disclosures. So, I mean, are we just too, is there this culture of secrecy in this country that we need to change?
Yeah, so I think there's a culture of secrecy undoubtedly in the UK, which is greatly in excess of that which exists in Scandinavia. And if you look at Sweden and Norway, and as I say, I've made requests there, and I've talked to a lot of people over the years in Sweden and Norway about FOI, they respond much more quickly to FOI requests. Officials treat it as a priority part of their work to actually do that kind of thing in a way which officials in this country very rarely do, it has to be said. And there is a culture of openness unless there is a genuine reason for keeping something secret. Whereas I think in this country, amongst the world of officialdom, there is a culture of let's keep it secret unless we have to put it out in the open.
I mean, okay. I was just going to try and widen the conversation out into another area. Andrew and I were just talking about Julian Assange. I know it's not a story you particularly want to talk about, but does all this freedom of information regulation and all the tribunals of the systems that you've been discussing, how does that bear upon the world of leaks and hacks? Because that's another way important information enters the public domain, sometimes leaked by the people in charge of it, sometimes, as in the case of Assange, obtained illegally. But nevertheless, is it important? Should people like that be protected more than
So there's definitely a relationship between the world of FOI and the world of leaks. And one of the most acute examples of that, in a way, was the MP's expenses scandal, which is obviously, you know, massive, massive, massive scandal in this country, very politically significant. What happened there was the information that was eventually leaked to the Daily Telegraph as it was being processed had only been compiled together in response to a whole batch of Freedom of Information requests. So it was the FOI requests that first of all forced the collation of the material, some of which would have been redacted, but it was then all leaked to the Telegraph. So sometimes, you know, sometimes these things do operate in tandem. And for example, you know, as a journalist, I think I've had people who might previously have leaked a document to me say to me, since FOI has come in, sources have said, you should put in an FOI request for this document, and told me what the actual document is that I should request. And then I get it. And I think, so sometimes I think the result has been that sometimes officials who want to leak you something as a journalist instead tell you to put in an FOI request for it. So there is a certain degree of, you know, synergy between the two. That's absolutely true.
Do you think things are becoming more open? I mean, is the FOI Act working, or are authorities learning some of the tricks about how to frustrate requesters?
So I think things are getting less open, actually. And I think we've seen, if you look at the statistics, the central government statistics, that the number of requests which are completely denied is going up, and the number of requests which are completely responded to in full, all the information given, that's going down. And that's a trend we've seen over the past 15 years since, or so, a bit longer since FOI came into force. And so it is true, I think, that there is more resistance giving out information. Some people say it's because the requests coming in now are different. Maybe that's a factor. It's difficult to be sure. But I think there is more resistance. But I think what's also true is at the sort of political level, at the, you know, in terms of the sort of rhetoric about it that is coming from government. When FOI first came in, although Tony Blair later decided it was one of his two really bad decisions, there was a kind of, you know, encouragement from the top. We've got this new law. Let's use it. Give out information. There was a kind of encouragement of openness in theory. And then when Cameron came in, and there was a Cameron government, there was quite a lot of encouragement then for the notion of open data, publishing information about government performance, financial data, and so on, forcing local councils to do so, which is not the same as FOI. It's proactive publication rather than answering questions, but it's got stuff in common. And again, we had that, you know, some of that rhetoric about open government. We haven't seen any of that really, I would say, in the past 5 years or so. That kind of rhetoric from the top, theoretically encouraging openness anyway, has completely dissipated. I don't see any likelihood of that coming back in the near future. And I must say, I can't see any evidence it's anything that Keir Starmer feels very enthusiastic about.
So the leak needs to come from politicians. It's not the civil servants who are frustrating the system.
I think it's both. I mean, I think absolutely the lead from politicians helped, for sure. But I think also there is sometimes obstruction from officials, absolutely. You know, I mean, I know from talking to people about it, quite often there are internal discussions within public authorities about my requests or other people's requests. And sometimes you have the FOI officer who's dealing with your request saying to the senior management, legally we've got to give this information out. And the senior management doesn't want to give it out because it's too embarrassing. And they try and say things like, well, we're not going to give it out. If the ICO eventually rules against us, so be it. We'll wait several months for that to happen. So, you know, it's not like any of these organizations are a monolithic. They've got different people within them who've got different views, both amongst the politicians and amongst the officials.
And I mean, what changes would you like to see take place that would make the system more open?
So I think what we really need for a start are time limits for FOI requests. I mean, they're meant to be answered within 20 working days, but if the public authority says it needs longer to assess the public interest in answering a request, that can be extended for as long as is reasonable.
Supposedly. I've just had one for a year.
Exactly, exactly. So you should be complaining to the Information Commissioner about that.
Yeah, don't worry.
Good, good. I'm glad to hear that. So so there should be time limits in the law for that, and also for internal reviews, internal appeals. That's already the case in Scotland, that there are specific time limits for this. So I think it should apply in the legislation that covers the UK as a whole. I think we also would want to see the Act extended to some other organisations. For example, this is probably of particular interest to you, Andrew. It doesn't cover the Royal Household. And, you know, certainly I think it should cover the Royal Household. It should also cover what's an increasing phenomenon where you have private companies who are contracted to deliver public services by council or whatever. Obviously, it's a very big feature of the public sector now that private companies are commissioned to do this kind of stuff. And where that happens, they should be subject to freedom of information. So I think we need to get cracking down on delays into the legislation, and we also need to extend the law.
And do people understand really how important freedom of information is? I mean, it's, you know, there are organisations like the Campaign for Freedom of Information, which were both involved, and people don't really, you know, support them in the way one would hope. Is FOI just something that doesn't impinge on most people's lives and they're just happy to go along, unless you're a journalist or writer?
Yeah, I think actually it impinges on more people's lives in some ways than, you know, perhaps one might expect. I mean, there was one opinion poll which suggested that, I think it said something like 14% of the population said they put in an FOI request. Even if you don't think that is really true, that might, you know, even if that's exaggerated, seems pretty clear to me, given the numbers of FOI requests there are, that millions of people must have put in at least one FOI request over the past 17 years. So, you know,
it was mostly Andrew, actually. he's about 87% of the national figures. they're all behind him. That's what that pile is behind him.
you can see that they even use different names. You know, I have doppelgangers.
And you're also answering these opinion poll questions as well, maybe. Yeah, all that is, maybe that's true. But I think, you know, I find talking to people, a lot of people say to me, oh, I have actually put in an FOI request. Perhaps not very many, but I think people may have put in one or two and have got some experience of using the legislation. So I think it's actually perhaps a surprising number of people have actually made some attempt to use it. Doesn't necessarily mean that they've got the information they wanted, of course.
And what were the successes, for example, when you're at the BBC? Because, I mean, clearly programmes often were developed as a result of your requests.
Yeah, so there were all sorts of requests. I mean, so I mentioned the, you know, the one, for example, about Charles and lobbying over genetically modified foods. But one that I particularly liked in a way, although it's a different kind of thing, perhaps, but... it took me 18 months to get this information from the Department for Transport, but it was information about which makes and models of cars are most likely to fail MOT tests, which, you know, the Department for Transport had from all its MOT testing systems. And I thought it'd be in the public interest for the public to know which makes and models of cars are most reliable. And they turned it down on the grounds it was commercially confidential information, wouldn't release it. Eventually, the Information Commissioner did rule that it should be released. And the short sort of summary of the information, by the way, is that you're better off with a Honda than you are with a Renault.
You learn all sorts of new things on this podcast.
But bang goes our sponsorship deal with Renault. Damn it. Yeah.
So we did that story. But the thing I particularly like about that example, actually, and why I quote it, is that now this information is published regularly by the Department for Transport as open data. So all these car websites that like to compare cars, they're using all the time to analyze it. And in other words, this information, which the Department for Transport were telling me for 18 months, was too secret, too confidential, too damaging to be out in the open, is now something they release proactively on a regular basis. And gosh, that actually is an example of
that's FOI. That's really good. And I think that goes to the psychological importance of what you do, I think, because it's about feeling not only that you're in a free country, but you're in a country where your relationship with those who govern you is open. And
trust.
Trust.
Yeah.
So many people don't feel that, I'm afraid. And that's a shame. Yeah. And I think what you're doing is shoving that process forward. So good on you.
Yeah. Good.
And I mean, are there penalties? I mean, you know, what can the ICO do if people just ignore them, like the Cabinet Office? And I mean, the problem is the Cabinet Office, to a certain degree, have some regulation over their regulator. They're not totally independent.
Yes, so the ICO does actually, in a sense that FOI policy is determined by the Cabinet Office. The ICO does have that kind of relationship with them. But the ICO only has limited powers to enforce the law, in the sense that what it can do, it can tell public authorities, release the information. It can conduct investigations into authorities that are particularly bad and tell them to speed up their processes and so on. But it can't, in the FOI world, issue fines, for example, whereas it also deals with data protection cases. In the data protection world, it can fine organizations that don't abide by the law. In the FOI world, it can't do that. Basically, all it can tell authorities to do is obey the law, release this information.
So should we be bringing in legislation for fines and proper penalties? Or is it the problem that government actually doesn't want transparency and scrutiny?
So I think government is certainly not enthusiastic about transparency. As I say, it was introduced. There was an initial wave of some kind of enthusiasm for it. That has completely dissipated. I certainly think that the ICO needs to be given more funding so it can properly have a proper enforcement program where it's properly tackling the worst public authorities, and it needs more funding from the government to do that. And I don't think the government wants to provide it with the level of funding which would really enable it to carry out its duties to the best effect.
I mean, the clever thing would be for a government on the way out, like the present one, to bring in this legislation and cause problems for their successor.
Well, yes, that's not a bad strategy, actually, isn't it? I mean, it's certainly true that politicians in opposition tend to have much more enthusiasm for FOI. They're always putting in FOI requests. They're always condemning the government for not responding to FOI requests properly, all the rest of it. When they find themselves in government, they tend to lose their enthusiasm for FOI. That's something that we've seen from a range of political parties, absolutely.
But I mean, FOI is for everyone. I mean, you've just published a book, which really is a guide to how to go through the FOI policy. And I think does that cover other countries as well as Britain?
Yeah, there's a bit about other countries in it. So, for example, making FOI requests in the United States and so on. There's a bit about that. It's called Freedom of Information, a Practical Guidebook. And it's exactly what it says on the tin. It's advice about how you can phrase requests to make them most effective, about the requirements of the law, how to fight your case through various parts of the system. And I've got to say that the phraseology of your request is really incredibly important. And a lot of people don't get the information that they're wanting because they put in requests which are too vague, can be interpreted in all sorts of different ways. They haven't thought hard enough about what they really want. And trying to make your requests specific and clear and straightforward is a really important part of making sure you get the information that you're trying to get.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's very helpful. We'll give we'll put a note about the book at the end.
Yes, we will.
Right.
Semantics is one of the problems I find. If it's too broad, they say it's too broad. If it's too narrow, they hide behind that and say, you haven't asked, you know, we haven't got this information. Yeah. It's very, very tricky. It's like whack-a-mole, really, isn't it?
Absolutely. And so another thing is that persistence is definitely part of using the law when you're trying to get stuff that people don't want to release to you. Persistence is definitely a big part of it. Yeah.
Great. Well, this has been terrific. Thank you. This goes
no, very, very, very good of you to give us a kind of a bluffer's guide to freedom of information.
Yeah, that, so much we do relies on this. So it's...
I'm going to go and buy a Honda now. So at least I've learned something today. Many things. Thank you so much, Martin.
Thanks a lot,
keep
Martin.
Fighting the good fight, comrade. Okay. See you later.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.